Welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte, a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real-life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, check me out at ritaschulte.com. That's S-C-H-U-L-T-E.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. You can also find me on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC or follow me on Twitter at Heartline Pod. So let's get going on this journey of the heart. I can't explain why I decided to eat again, except for the way I saw myself clearly one day for the skeleton that I was. And I wanted then more than anything to be normal. It was never about the food and all about the scapegoats. Eventually, we're left emptier for trying to pass the blame. That's a quote by Emily Waringa from her book Chasing Silhouettes, How to Help a Loved One Battling an Eating Disorder. Emily's struggle with anorexia began when she was only 9 years old. Today, she's healthy and happy, and she's on a mission to help other young women find freedom. Here's her story. Emily, welcome to Heartline.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your story with anorexia began at a really young age. You were 9 years old. Help us understand how a 9-year-old develops an eating disorder.
Well, yes, my case was particularly unique back in the 80s because of my situation. I was a pastor's daughter who had moved 10 times before the age of 7. You know, I was homeschooled, so I didn't have a lot of social life. Homeschooling wasn't as predominant as it is today. And my father admits now that he put ministry before family. So he was always at the church, away from the home, or even if he was at home, he was working on a sermon or something. My mom was very she had low self-esteem. She battled just loneliness and sadness and didn't know how to compliment her children. I was the oldest of 4 children. I was expected to take care of my younger siblings because my dad wasn't home to help my mom. So it was just basically the recipe for a perfect storm.
Mm. Okay, so you had no voice basically in the family system. There were just rules.
Mm-hmm.
How did you deal with that, Emily?
Well, you know, initially I tried to deal with it by doing poetry and art, but the pain just got so deep. And because we were raised by parents who believed that children should be, you know, kind of seen and not heard, especially in the public eye, and because we were expected to be very well behaved because we were pastor's children, I just kind of sunk into myself. And I realized one day that one thing that I could control was my eating. And it gave me some sense of liberation, you know. It was the only thing that I had a choice in, and so I clung to it.
So nothing happened on the front end of that? Like, your parents didn't focus on weight or food? You didn't have any peers saying, oh my gosh, you know, you're chubby? There was nothing on the front end of that that might have implanted that belief?
No. Now, my mom did the exact opposite. She was a nutritionist, and she was very well aware of eating disorders. So she made sure her kids wouldn't get one. She fed us very healthy food. She didn't let us play with Barbie dolls. She wouldn't let us take dance lessons. There were no fashion magazines, you know. So she tried everything in her power to keep us from getting an eating disorder. I had no idea about eating disorders. I didn't know about anorexia. All I knew was the pain that I had inside me. So my mom, bless her heart, did everything within her power to keep us from knowing that world.
So because you had all these restrictions, like, you know, couldn't play with the dolls, you know, had to eat healthy, what was the message that you got because of that?
Yes, the message that I got was that we don't focus on flesh, we don't focus on the body, we don't talk about the body. You know, what matters is what's inside, which is very true.
Mm-hmm.
But there was basically an avoidance of the flesh. So we were actually kind of scared of showing anything, our midriff, our shoulders, our, you know, that's a bit extreme. But basically, mm-hmm. you know, we would panic if our dad saw our bra lying around. You know, it's just, we were very scared. And I didn't hear that I was beautiful. I didn't hear that I was pretty. I was told that was vanity. I just was so starved for some form of attention.
Yeah.
So
you kind of got a message that focusing on the body or the body itself was bad?
That's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was taught that vanity. I was taught it was vanity instead of, you know, just loving the creation that God had made you to be.
Right. So it's almost like then a kid develops this sense, well, oh my gosh, this is sin. This is wrong. You know, I'm bad if I feel this or want this or need this.
That's mm-hmm. right. Yeah, you're ashamed.
Okay, so what was your concept of God like? Here you are, a pastor's kid. You know, you have all these rules and regulations, kind of a rigid environment. How did you view God, especially in light of the fact that Dad was always busy doing his work? Was there resentment there, anger?
Definitely. At first, you know, God was, you know, just a figure to be feared. I knew I was meant to have a personal relationship with him. But because I didn't have a personal relationship with my parents, you know, who adored God and taught me this, I didn't know how to go beyond that. I didn't know how to reach God because I was so lonely in my human existence. So I did begin to resent him because he always stole my dad from me. My dad was always happier at church than he was at home. You know, my mom said she loved him, but she was always sad. And, you know, I just thought he was kind of just, you know, a stern pastor figure who had all these rules, and I was a good kid. I tried to obey them as much as I could. I got, you know, baptized when I was 8 because I thought maybe my dad would want to spend time with me then. You know, I tried to fill the role, and I never stopped believing in him, but I don't know that I had ever let him into my heart because my heart was too wounded.
Sure. So this try harder life you were living in order to try to get your dad's attention, were you aware of that as a child or maybe even as a teenager?
No, I didn't really think about the issues that were causing my anorexia. I knew that there was pain. I knew that I fought physically against my father. You know, when I was sick with anorexia, I told him I hated him. I had all this pent-up anger, but I didn't know why.
Sure.
It wasn't until years later when I decided to dig to the root of things after I had relapsed as a young married woman that I realized it stemmed from, you know, pain with my parents. And nowadays we're taught that eating disorders, you know, it's not the parents' fault. And I agree, you know, my parents were wounded too. They had broken childhoods. And they had distorted views of God themselves and ministry, but they did play a part in my eating disorder.
Did you believe your parents loved you?
Yes, in the sense that I was very well taken care of. All of my physical needs were taken care of, but my emotional ones were not. So I believed love was a very distant word, you know. It was a foreign concept that they said they did. My dad would kiss me on the cheek in the morning and say he loved me, and my mom would make me homemade meals and homeschool me, but I didn't feel anything.
Mm-hmm. How about acceptance? Did you feel that you were accepted unconditionally, say, apart from your performance?
Definitely not.
Yeah.
No, I always felt that I needed to do something to gain my parents' approval, because maybe if I just, you know, was, you know, better at school or better at art or better looking, they might suddenly, you know, overwhelm me with praise and hugs and kisses. And
sure, they would notice you.
Yes.
And I think that's the big key. I often ask clients that question, you know, do you feel that your parents loved you? Big difference between, you know, feeling unconditionally accepted, because that really speaks about performance. And so mm-hmm. we get hooked into this try harder, people pleasing, p- performance-based acceptance system. And after a while, you know, we begin to realize there's no life there.
Mm-hmm.
We're just worn out.
That's right.
Okay, so looking back, what were you lacking? I mean, you said you were lacking this nurturing. Anything else that you can put your finger on?
I was lacking just listening ears. I was lacking communication with my parents. I was lacking friendship, you know, socially. And I was lacking the choice. You know, I didn't have choice. And so because I was a very independent, artistic, sensitive child, those were things that spoke my love language, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if those things had been met, I'm not sure that I would have needed to go to extremes to express myself.
So choice, can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, just even choice over, you know, what kind of clothes I wore, you know, or...
So they told you what to do with all that. Like, you can't wear this, you can't play with the Barbies, you can't listen to this music.
Yeah, okay. Basically, yeah. You know, choice over, you know, even, you know, if my dad had involved us in the move, you know, when, you know, he was picked up and moved for his job, if he had just asked us our thoughts on that,
mm-hmm.
you know, choice over homeschooling, because we were just pulled out of school and homeschooled, you know, so just choice in daily life, too, just in small things, like what would you like to eat for supper, you know, like, or, you know, just paying attention to the details, like, how did you feel about that, you know?
Yeah, so basically, like, you know, connecting to your heart
mm-hmm.
and what was going on there. That's really huge. I think so much of the eating disorder piece that we hear about, that we read about, that I see as a counselor is this whole idea of no voice. And mm-hmm. when I don't have a voice, then I shut down, I turn inward, and I look for something else to fill me for whatever mm-hmm. it is I'm lacking. So I kind of create this false self
mm-hmm.
In order to get my needs met and cope with life.
That's right. Yeah.
Do you think you were trying to punish yourself in any way?
Oh, definitely. I hated myself in as much as I said I hated my father, you know, and my mother to an extent. It's just I hated because I couldn't have the love reciprocated, the love that I needed. So I just resorted to the opposite, you know, because I was hurting too badly. And, you know, hating myself gave me a reason to, you know, keep cutting back, keep punishing, you know, keep being harder and harder on myself. And it actually felt good. The pain felt good. Because finally, you know, I was getting some kind of attention, even if it was negative.
Mm-hmm. So you were looking through this lens of how your parents viewed you, and your beliefs may have been, and jump in if I don't have this right, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not good enough, I'm not worthy of love, I'm not cherished, things
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, that gave you, you know, messages, your parents' nearness, attunement, emotional availability to you. And you use that as a lens to define yourself.
Right.
And that's where the self-hatred developed out of those beliefs.
Right.
Okay.
Because, you know, I think, you know, as Christians, you know, there are layers, right, to our relationship with Christ. And
mm-hmm.
my parents, they loved Christ, but they hadn't absorbed their identity in Christ for themselves. They hadn't realized that they were redeemed, they were forgiven, they were accepted, they were cherished. So they couldn't pass that identity on to their children. So all that was passed down were the laws. You know, there was no spirit, there was no heart. It was just the laws, and that can just drive a child to her grave if she lets it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then we want to rebel against law. I mean, that's, you know, look around us, people, that's what we have laws, but people are always rebelling against the laws.
Mm-hmm.
So you were a compliant child.
Mm-hmm.
How did the eating disorder change that, or did it?
Yeah, oh, it definitely did. I was very meek and quiet and good and obedient until I realized that was doing nothing for me.
wasn't getting what I needed that way.
So then I still was meek and quiet, but I quietly stopped eating. And the more I starved my body, the more I starved my brain, and the less I was able to keep control of the anger that was building within me.
And so what did that look like in the home? Like in the book, you go into great lengths about how, you know, your rage just kind of spilled out.
Yeah.
And was that directed particularly at your parents, your siblings?
Yeah, no, it was mostly at my parents, a little bit at my siblings, but not too much. I tried to spare them as much as possible. I think my brother egged me on a bit because he used to be my best friend, and now I just spent time alone. So he would insult me on purpose because he was hurting, you know. So that was the only retaliation I had towards my siblings. But it was mostly towards my father, actually. I knew my mom was hurting, too. I deep down knew that. And I was just, yeah, very angry at him. And, you know, every day I would have a temper tantrum. Every day I would make very well known my thoughts on the meal we were having and what I was not going to eat. And I would physically fight my father, like I said, like punch him and yell at him. And it was very, very awful. I would slam my door every day.
And so what did your dad do? How did he handle that?
My father actually was great through it all. He was very consistent with telling me that he loved me every morning, that he continued to kiss me on the cheek every morning. And they did eventually seek counseling once my mom realized I did have an eating disorder. It took a while for her to get out of that denial, you know. And once they stopped trying to fix me with things, you know, like menus and charts, and realized it was a deeper thing, we did go to family counseling. But that just infuriated me because they weren't talking to me directly. They were getting someone else to talk to me. And so I just stopped eating further, you know. I just wanted them to come into my bedroom and say sorry, you know, sorry that, you know, we've messed up. We're human. Please forgive us and tell us how you're feeling. That's all I needed, really.
Wow. Yeah, I was going to ask you, what do you think you needed? And through that counseling, did you voice that in the counseling? I mean,
no, because, you know, I didn't know that that's what I needed. I look back and I see, you know, that I was you know, when you're starving yourself, you're just so caught up in food. It's not like all you think about. And then the emotions are just either anger or happiness, anger or sadness. Like, there's no reasoning because your body's too exhausted. So looking back, I can see that that would have healed a lot, you know,
yeah.
But I didn't know that.
Yeah, because you said in the book it was never about the food and all about the scapegoats. Is that what you meant?
Yes, that's right. Well, it was all about what not eating was accomplishing.
Mm-hmm. And it was hurting them. It was getting them, and you were looking for, you know, them to care. I mean, okay, so here your dad is, your parents, your family is, I guess, showing concern about the fact that you're not eating.
Right.
And so what kind of goes on in a person's mind? Because, you know, this is going to be really important for other people, parents especially, as they listen and try to understand what's going on in the child's mind in terms of, okay, here we are. We're trying to show affection.
Right.
It's not what you need, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing. You know, eventually you get so sick that what you need is not something your parents can give you at that point.
Yeah.
And that's the hard part, because eventually it does become about food or not eating, you know. And for me, it was an addiction like it is for every disordered eater. It, you know, it took a hold of me. And so all I was doing was measuring my worth based on the numbers on the scale. And, you know, they would, even if they had tried to apologize, you know, 2 years into my eating disorder or 3 years into it, I'm not sure it would have registered at that point because I was so starved.
Sure. And then that all kinds of stuff starts happening in your brain and your physical body as a result of the starvation.
And I would say, you know, for the Christian listeners, you know, that it is a spiritual battle. You know, that you're hearing messages from, you know, who I would say is Satan, every day telling you that you're worthless, you know, telling you that you'll matter if you just lose one more pound. And you're believing all those lies because he was the one to, first of all, woo you in and say, you'll look so much better and you'll be loved if you, you know, just skip this meal. And so it's a voice that you've learned to trust, but eventually it becomes a voice that you hate, but you don't know how to escape it. It's been so long since you've been tuned into God's whisper that you've forgotten how to hear it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I call it the imposter. I mean, it's this false self, this second identity, which actually overtakes, you know, your primary identity, who you are in Christ. And as a small kid, you know, we're seeing eating disorders develop earlier and earlier in people's lives. I mean, you were 9. You didn't even have the cognitive capacity to be able to think abstractly or reason. Mm-hmm. You know, kids are very egocentric at that point.
Yeah.
And so you don't have the reasoning skills to be able to say, oh, A, B, C, D.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, so what is it that parents need to know on the front end of this thing when they first are observing symptoms in their kid? And you made a really important point I didn't want to miss about denial. A lot of times parents are in denial because if they admit their kid has a problem or an eating disorder, then that says something about them and their parenting, I think.
That's right. Yeah.
So, you know, after they've broken through that, what needs to happen on the front end of this thing from the parents, do you think?
Yeah. Okay, well, as soon as you notice, you know, your child restricting or overeating, you know, whatever it is, we hear that it's bad to talk about the body. We hear that you should just avoid it and ignore it. But I say, please don't. You know, please, first of all, recognize how you treat your own body. You know, get right with your own body before you approach your daughter or son about hers or his.
Mm-hmm.
So learn to love your body. Look at your arms, say thank you for carrying my child. Look at your legs, say thank you for carrying my body. Look into the mirror and say, I love you. You know, and it hurts to say it. It really feels weird and hard, but something will change, you know, and you'll start to value yourself, and then you'll be able to genuinely speak into the heart of your suffering child. And it might not be your fault. It could very easily be bullies at school that are saying mean things to your kid. It could be a sexual assault that you didn't know about that happened to your child. But you need to get right first with your body and your God before you can speak to your child. And then you can go and speak out of love, you know, not fear.
Yeah, absolutely. How did you turn the corner, Emily?
Well, at 13, you know, I would say I initially turned the corner when my parents put me into the hospital. They just put me into the general hospital. I was, you know, 60 pounds, 5'4", and, you know, just hypothermia. The nurses couldn't believe I was still alive. And I remember driving to the hospital and looking out the window and seeing this beautiful muscular woman who was jogging in the park, and it's like my eyes were opened. And I know my mother was praying those 4 years I had anorexia. She prayed so much, and that's the reason my eyes were opened, I believe, just to see that I was not living. I couldn't walk anymore, barely. I couldn't lift a bat. My hair was falling out. My nails were cracking. I hadn't gotten my period yet. Doctors were saying I wouldn't be able to have children. And it's like, this is hell, you know? And suddenly, God's whisper comes through, you know?
Wow.
And that's the breaking point. That's when you know, there's a chance for life. And so I got to the hospital, they placed food in front of me, and I began to eat. You know, and that seems really simple and easy. And for the next 10 years, that was fine. I didn't have to deal with the issues that had caused it in the first place. But then I went on a missions trip. When I was engaged, I went for 6 months to the Middle East, and, you know, I ate whatever I wanted over there because, you know, people just kept putting food in front of me, and I thought, you know, it was a loving thing to do, to eat what they wanted me to eat. And at the end of the trip, someone said that I'd put on weight, and I immediately dropped the sandwich I was eating and fell hard back into anorexia, and my husband married a girl he didn't recognize, and, you know, it was 3 years of battle, you know, again.
Well, do you think you didn't deal with some of the underlying issues from the first go-round?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I didn't deal with the issues because, you know, I just kind of wanted to move on, you know, to forget that had happened, that stage of life had happened. But, you know, upon getting married, you know, I had another authority figure in my life, you know, my husband, and I hadn't dealt with my, you know, issues with my father, and, you know, it's just the ripple effect, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one day, you know, when I was very sick and wasn't sleeping, you know, just drinking 9 cups of coffee a day, only eating a bit for supper, and my husband, you know, just turned to me and said, Emily, you have to choose between me or food because otherwise I'm done. I can't sit and watch you die. And that ultimatum came at the right time in my life. You know, He just, the Holy Spirit must have prompted him, because I knew then that I had to choose, and thankfully I chose him. And, you know, that's when I started to dig deep and, you know, realize the issues that had caused it in the first place.
Right. Now, did you have counseling to help you through dealing with those issues?
Actually, I didn't. You know, we just dropped everything and moved to Korea and taught English for a year. And I learned to love my husband again and food again. And then actually I ended up going home to take care of my mom, who had brain cancer. And it was while I was at home taking care of her and living, you know, close to my parents again, that I started to see them for the broken people that they were, you know, mm-hmm. and to realize, you know, to forgive them, you know, and that forgiveness caused a lot of healing in itself.
Oh my gosh, yes. What's the takeaway from your story, Emily? What do you want people to know? From this book, and I know you've written another one with Dr. Cabrera, mm-hmm. Mom in the Mirror.
You know, we all have hang-ups. We all have addictions. We all have strongholds, and we all have pain. Mine manifested itself in an eating disorder. I think as a church, what we need to do is not, you know, barricade those who are struggling with mental illness or pain, which is all of us, but to open up the doors, you know, and let people talk. Let people share their stories and find the thread of redemption, you know, and just follow that thread. And I think the more we allow our pain to surface, the more we'll find our way to the cross. But because we're pretending that there's nothing wrong, we don't need Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, it's only when we acknowledge our pain and our brokenness that we need him.
Powerful point. We need to take off our masks and be willing to get real with people. And this is just a timely topic in light of what's happened with Rick Warren's son and so many people we see in the church who are taking their lives and struggling with mental illness. I think talking, being real, removing our masks is key to the freedom. Emily, thank you for taking time out of your schedule to share with us today.
Thank you, Rita.
God bless you as you move forward in ministering to those who are hurting.
You too.
Bye-bye. Thanks for joining me today. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to be a guest on Heartline, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at ritaschulte.com, on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or Twitter at Heartline Pod. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.